catching pythons, catching buses, and preparing for a new hurricane season. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A new hurricane season is upon us. It starts on Friday. But what sort of season can we expect? Also, hunters recently captured their 1,000th python, a species that's devastated the Everglades.
99% of the fur-bearing animals have been eliminated by the python.
We'll talk to a hunter about what it's like to capture and kill this invasive species. Ridership of Miami buses and public transit is dropping annually. We're going to talk with a group about a new campaign called Where's My Bus? Finally, Miami-Dade County schools have only one counselor for every 500 or so students. A teacher in South Florida has come up with an app that could help kids find assistance when dealing with mental health issues. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, hurricane season starts Friday, June 1st, this Friday. But Mother Nature obviously doesn't really care to follow calendars, as we've seen with Tropical Storm Alberto this past weekend. Alberto did not grow to a hurricane, but it's dropped a lot of rain throughout Florida, and we're still feeling it here in South Florida. What sort of season are we going to have, and how should we look at the different forecasting models as they show all of these possible potential paths for storms? What's changed? Well, we're joined now by Chief Meteorologist for the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network in Gainesville, Jeff Hoffman, a voice you hear quite often during hurricane season. Jeff, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Louis. Nice to be here.
All right. So what should we make of the forecast that came out recently, which says we're likely to have a near normal, above normal season?
Yeah, near to above normal. And I treat these forecasts every year. It's a talking point to kind of get us in the mindset. A hurricane season's coming. But we have to kind of remember that they really have an accuracy rate that's only slightly better than the groundhog in terms of predicting the overall seasonal activity. And the forecasts have nothing to do with where a storm might go, how strong it might be, what type of land it might affect. But near to above normal, that was similar to the forecast last year for slightly above normal. So I think conditions are there for several storms again this year throughout the Atlantic Basin.
All right. So what's changed in the forecasting of storms? And not just, I mean, before the season starts. I'm talking about as we get into the season and storms start to form, what's changed in the technology and how we're tracking them?
Yeah, absolutely. The improvements have been made most significantly in two areas, and that's more of a messaging and communications situation where the storm surge risk and the water hazards. I think there's proof over the last few years that the technology in terms of the ways of communicating that hazard has improved. An example, we don't want to ride this example too long, but an example last year of that is the storm surge threats from both Harvey and Irma and even Nate. They were all significant in their own ways, and there were no fatalities attributed to the storm surge from all three of those hurricanes last year, two of them, of course, major. Even Maria did not have any known deaths from the surge itself in Puerto Rico. But the second thing that has improved in the last few years and really over the last couple of decades is the track forecast. It's something that everybody, of course, pays very close attention to. Everybody seems to be very self-centered about the track, meaning they think there was an inaccuracy if it maybe doesn't hit them. But keep in mind, that margin of error, that cone that we see every year, is a very calculated thing, very calculated width to it, and it's come down even a little more this year because of some improvements in that overall forecast track.
Let's talk about that cone, the cone of probability, right? It's like, I mean, you see it from far away, and it's really wide, but how are we supposed to look at what the cone is telling us, you know, and how much do we trust it?
Well, I'd say it's a good tool to really look at days 3, 4, and 5, and maybe beyond if you see it kind of heading in your direction. It's just a general guidance as to where the storm may track. But you have to remember that as the storm gets closer to you, where the cone can be misleading is that the cone naturally gets narrower the sooner it's supposed to arrive. For example, yesterday, as the Alberto was coming ashore in the Panhandle, the cone only covered a few dozen miles there in the Panhandle. But we know the effects from that storm spread hundreds of miles, even unfortunately up into portions of North Carolina. So you have to remember that the hazards associated with a tropical event are far more reaching than just the width of the cone.
All right. Let's talk about Alberto. What caused Alberto, and is that normal to see something this early?
It's not like unprecedented. We typically get a storm in the Atlantic Basin once every 10 years, so it's not unheard of. We have had in recent years more preseason activity. We had a rare hurricane in January a couple of years ago, and then we had one in April last year. So it's not unusual. We had Tropical Storm Beryl a few years ago that hit Northeast Florida on Memorial Day weekend. So it's happened before, and unfortunately there was some damage, and unfortunately a couple of fatalities from Alberto, but overall this was more of a nuisance to most of Florida, and I think it serves as a great reminder that the season is upon us. And don't forget also, Lewis, the heart of the hurricane season, the most active period, is still 2.5 months away or so, from mid to late August on. So let's not let our guard down, even though it may be quiet for the next 6 or 8 weeks.
But looking at Alberto, does that tell us anything about what kind of season we have coming up, or it's just an anomaly?
It's kind of just a thing. Preseason or early season activity does not correlate strongly to how the overall season may come about. And remember that when we get into August, September, October, typically the storms originate in the central Atlantic. It's early in the season and then again late in the season where you have some of these quick spin-ups in the Gulf and the Caribbean. So this is nothing too earth-shaking, if you will.
And, did we see from Alberto that cities, communities, they're prepared, they're ready?
I really haven't been able to look too. I know that there was a lot of social media videos posted yesterday, one quite hilarious one about people making fun of Alberto because it did not really cause significant damage. But, I think those areas, those residents in the panhandle have been, they've seen much, much worse before. So I think a lot of them are very thankful it didn't pan out to be as strong. I think the biggest impact from Alberto may have been on the pocketbooks of a lot of business owners in that area because of the holiday weekend.
And you know what? I guess finally looking at last season and everything we went through, I mean, Harvey, Irma, Maria, what's your concern going into this season? I mean, you talk about forecasting getting better and the communication getting better, but, is there a concern? What is your concern?
Yeah, my biggest concern, and it's a strong concern, Lewis, is that our Florida residents remember events and try to prepare for the next one based on their remembrance of those events and how it affected them. We've had two very unique hurricanes in the last 2 years. Matthew, skirted the coastline there in South Florida, did not really significantly impact South Florida, but really brought significant impacts to the Jacksonville area. And conversely, Irma went up kind of the left side of the coast, still hundreds of miles away from Jacksonville, and caused even worse damage there in terms of storm surge flooding than Matthew did. So it's just what my concern is that residents might relate too much to a prior storm and not prepare enough for the next one. And we have to remember that every single hurricane, even though we use the same cone, we produce the same forecast products for each one, they all have a different flavor and they're very much unique. And you have to really listen to local authorities and forecasts to kind of understand what type of hazards you're up against.
Jeff Huffman, again, chief meteorologist for the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, joining us from Gainesville. Yeah, Jeff, I want to say this. It's nice. It's great having you on. But I hope we don't hear from too much from you this season. OK.
Yeah. No offense taken. Same to you, Lewis. I hope we're not speaking to you as much this year.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. And just as a mention, too, I know public service announcement, you remember last year, right? You remember when you went to the stores and, they ran out of stuff really quick? Go stock up now. There. Okay. Still to come, would you get paid to hunt a 13-foot python at night in the Everglades? We're going to talk with a group whose job it is to do just that. All coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. The Burmese python has caused devastation on the Everglades ecosystem over the past several decades. Biologists estimate 99% of fur-bearing animals, foxes, rabbits, squirrels, etc., have been killed off by this invasive species. Well, the python's only natural predator is, of course, us, humans. So South Florida Water Management District decided to hire 25 hunters, paying a minimum wage, plus there's a bounty for every python they catch. And that bounty, of course, increases by size of the snake. And last week, the Python Elimination Program captured its 1,000th snake, an 11-foot-long male snake. Mike Kirkland, is overseeing the Elimination Program and is the project manager. Mike, great to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Also joining me is Tom Rahill. Tom, did I say that right?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. He's an IT specialist by day, and he's a python hunter by night.
There you go.
You sound, it's like a superhero. By day, you got this job, then you put on the cape and you go out, you're a python hunter
by
night.
Yeah, I'm a
I'm a guide to superheroes. We work with veterans, so the real superheroes are the veterans.
Thank you for bringing that up. I do appreciate that. Tom, let me start with you, though. Why do you do this?
I started about 10 years ago. My wife took a job teaching in Arkansas, and to deal with my grief for missing her. We're still married, still in love, going on 37 years, so it was a tough time. I went in the Everglades to volunteer to take my mind off of the pain that I felt from missing her. I'd only see her every couple of months, and during that time I was invited to join the Everglades National Park Python Eradication Program. With relatives serving in the military at the time, it occurred to me that this would be a great activity for them to get their mind off of their issues when they come back.
Do you remember the first python you caught?
Yeah, I do, actually, and it was before that. It was I used to hang out in Big Cypress and other areas, and I got a couple of pythons over the years and called up, and no one really knew what to do. It was interesting. I got a python. Well, okay. You know, it was pretty wild. I've caught hundreds and hundreds now, so I'm past the point of really remembering too much.
I want to ask you about how you go about doing that, how you catch them. But Mike, let me ask you this. The program now has caught its 1,000th python. What's the consensus amongst hunters and for the program? It's success or, I mean, come on, really, how many are there out there?
Well, we really don't know because of the cryptic nature of this species and the vastness of the Everglades and the relative inaccessibility of the Everglades. We can't do a conventional population estimate on this animal, so we can only guess how many are out there, and I've heard anywhere between 10,000 and 200,000. Now that we've caught 1,000 in a year's time, you know that estimate is, I would guess, is towards the upper end of that range. But we've never seen a management effort this successful before. We haven't seen this many pythons removed from the Everglades in the same amount of time.
By the way, how many times did you hear people like Tom come along and say, hey, I caught some pythons, so now what?
Yes, I've been following the issue down here for many years and have only been directly involved with management of this species, for the last year and a half. So I'm a relative newcomer compared to Tom, but Tom and others like him have been fighting against this population invasion in the Everglades for a long time.
What started the program? How did it get launched?
So it was our governing board decided that it was incumbent upon us as an agency and as the largest landowner in South Florida to do something against this invasive threat. We've spent about $3.6 billion on Everglades restoration. That's improving water quality and restoring natural flowways, maintaining sensitive levee systems.
Is getting rid of the python as important as all those restoration efforts?
Well, it is, because if we were just to let the pythons run over these restored lands, then all that work would be for naught.
Again, we're talking about the Python Elimination Program. This is from the South Florida Water Management District. And as I mentioned, they've hired hunters to go out and find the python, this invasive species that has caused so much damage in the Everglades. And Mike Kirkland, he oversees the program, but we're also talking with Tom Rahill, who's one of those hunters, because they only hired a couple dozen of them. Tom, who are the other hunters? Are they like you? Are they have a day job, and this is something that they're doing extra? Or, I mean, yeah, who are these folks?
Yeah, largely so. There's a cast of characters. You know, you have the usual suspects out there, some really colorful individuals and some very surprising. There's bankers out there. There's military folks.
I'm trying to picture this. Like, maybe somebody I know.
There's a population of folks like myself that have been involved for many, many, many years. And then there's new folks that are out there that Mike invited in and have really adapted well and do a great job.
Now, to be one of these hunters, though, I mean, you have to go through a specific type of training. What do you need to know to be a python hunter?
You just need to follow the rules. You know, there's concerns about damaging native wildlife. There's misidentification that's taken place of native snakes, venomous snakes, believe it or not. Some folks have actually misidentified rattlesnakes and cottonmouths for pythons. So there are some courses that you can take, and I recommend it to anyone that's interested in it. Go ahead and contact the responsible authorities like the FWC, like the district, and they can direct you to get training on identifying pythons.
And my understanding, Mike, that you had almost, 1,000 people who wanted those 25 positions, right?
We cut off the application process after 1,000 applicants came in from all over the world after just 4 days.
And so, I mean, how do you pick them? How do you decide?
So Tom Rahill and others like him were known quantities to us. They're people that have been volunteering for University of Florida, volunteering for Everglades National Park. We tried to pick people that had directly relevant experience. And that's one reason why our team has been such a success, is because we're able to pick from the best hunters of the state.
Tom, I want to know about the process of hunting a python. This is done exclusively at night?
No, there's two basic seasons. There's a dry season and a wet season, as we know in South Florida. The dry season typically is colder at night, so you would want to look from December to maybe March during the day when the snakes are dropping in temperature in the evenings. They come out during the day to bask in the sun. Other than that, from March to about November, when the rains start, they do come out more at night. So you'll be road cruising effectively.
And I mean, look, I have no idea. So this coming from, you know, a very amateur, is it that they're just out there easy to spot? They're what?
No, they're not easy to spot. I mean, sometimes you'll get lucky and they'll be out on a road. But that old Charlie Pride song, if you're familiar, the snakes crawl at night. That's pretty much what they do. So we ride on the levees. We ride on the roads. With us, with the Swamp Apes, we take the veterans out on canoes at times, on trails, backcountry, slogging through the sawgrass, get the hammocks, and go into some unusual places, hopefully to catch them, using the veterans as an incredibly highly trained tool. That's our goal. The pythons are need to be addressed, and we're blessed enough to be able to have a win-win situation to where we're dedicated to serving veterans through serving the wilderness. And that python hunting gets a lot of their attention. They join us, use their military skills, and we've been very successful in removing them.
Help me understand how you capture one. And by the way, just as you described this, I just want to say to people, please don't do this unless you've had the training. But how do you see one? How do you approach it?
Live capture, we have a policy. So what we'll do, depending upon the area, if it's down in the jungle, you want to get to the head as quickly as possible. If you control the head, generally speaking, you control the snake. So I'm old enough and shoe leather enough that I don't particularly mind the threat of being bitten. I rarely do get bitten. So I effectively treat the animal with respect and with as much kindness as I can. I mean, in a physical confrontation, but I'll try to grab them immediately behind the head. Then they throw coils on you. It's like an elbow. They'll throw like a start the coil, put an elbow on you, and then lower than that, another elbow, and then they'll try to wrap around you. So if it's a particularly big snake with some veterans and some other members out there, they'll get the body of the snake. And if you can stretch it out, you're able to prevent it from coiling. The snakes have one lung. We have two lungs. So we can exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide a lot easier, right? The snake has to expand and contract its body. It has no diaphragm, so it can't have the same exchange rate. So if you're Cuban coffeed up and you have enough energy, you can outlast the snake, and the snake will bonk effectively, and then it's a lot easier to handle.
But you never do this by yourself.
I do it by myself and had done it for years by myself. And then that's when the idea of involving the veterans, it's awesome. At 2-3 in the morning, standing there, calling my wife up in Arkansas. Hey, I got a 12-foot python. It's 3 in the morning. You know, I mean, it was a wild thing, you know, but I prefer, we're all about safety, as Mike and the district and everyone stresses, safety first. You know, we don't want anyone getting hurt. There's not just the damage or the danger from the damage of venomous snakes, but there's sharp rocks out there, pinnacle rocks, there's plants, poison wood is out there. If you're sensitive to poison ivy, poison wood is like poison ivy on steroids. There's gators, around any particular corner. I've been up on some spoil mounds 40 feet high, and I've seen gators up on there. So you want to be situationally aware. You want to have a good sense of who you are, what you're doing out there.
And Tom, what's the toughest fight you ever had with a python? What was it like?
It's exhausting. I'm getting kind of long in the tooth and a little out of shape. So that bonking and that, we call it doing the scalded monkey dance, to where if you just move around, you some of those snakes really cause you some problems. I had a Marine that started who had never captured snakes before, and we had got a 10-foot male and up during the breeding season. And so we brought the 10-foot male back to the canoe, and then I said, let's go back and take a look. So we took a look, and we found a big 14-foot female slithering away. It was a breeding aggregation that was starting. I was able to get the head, and I called to my guy, George, I'm going to need you to get the body. Can you get the body? And George came running over, and I really thought he was going to just jump on it, and he stopped. He just dead stopped. So now the snake is starting to throw coils on me, and it seemed like 10 seconds. It was probably only 2 seconds, but then George, like any good Marine, jumped on that snake, pulled that snake, but that thing fought us. We were in the thicket, crashing through the thicket. This poor journalist from Washington, D.C. was back in the canoe, sitting, just wondering what's going on, and we just fighting and back and forth, and we were able to subdue the animal and bring it back. It was an awesome day.
How long do you think you could keep doing this? I mean,
for me, it's always about the veterans, you know. So I want to keep it going until I can actually get a replacement. If you remember the Men in Black movie where Tommy Lee Jones talks to Will Smith and says, I'm not looking for a partner, I'm looking for a replacement. This program, the Swamp Apes, is so much bigger than myself, so much bigger than anyone that belongs to the organization. It helps the veterans with PTSD, with TBI, with other challenges from their service, or veterans that just want to come out and join us, use their military skills. It's a new mission. It's a new purpose. There's camaraderie. We're working with some professors from University of South Florida on developing an actual prescribable program. So once I get that program set up to where we can have veterans prescribed the Swamp Apes program, to have a therapist in the field with us just to talk, just to open them up. I've had these heroes tell me about their first kills, about friends dying. I mean, it brings tears to my eyes now thinking about it. And it's wonderful that they open up to me, but to have a professional therapist there, have them open up to that therapist, we can get to the core of what's bothering them a lot quicker. So once I get that component going to where we're prescribable, then I can back away. I want to be Swamp Apes Emeritus and be on the horizon when Mike's out there checking on his guys. And, oh, there's Tom. He used to do this all the time. He's on the horizon.
You know what, Mike? I was curious as to how often do you hear stories of people getting hurt and how bad are the injuries?
We've had no injuries of note through this program, thankfully, so far. We really have tried to pick people with skills out there and that are aware of their environment, like Tom was describing.
Now, just real quickly, what is it? You have to bring the snake in alive, dead or alive?
With our program, the snake needs to come into the check-in station where it's measured dead on arrival.
All right. You know, just to mention, the program has faced some criticism, as you know, from groups like PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. In December of last year, the organization sent a letter arguing the snake shouldn't be decapitated or shot multiple times, but through a single shot to the head. What was your response to that?
So we follow very closely the guidelines set forth by the American Veterinary Medical Association for euthanasia of these wild snakes, and that's extremely important to us.
What do you envision this program is going to become in the coming years? Do you think that 25 hunters is enough? We don't know how many snakes are out there, so I mean, does the program need to grow? Do you need to expand it?
Our program has expanded since the beginning. We've expanded into Collier County. We've expanded into Palm Beach County. We have the authority from the governing board to add a few more hunters as the budget and our project area allows. There are also sister programs out there. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, the FWC, has a sister program with extremely similar to ours. We have some overlapping project area and some exclusive project areas that both agencies have. These are just tools in a large toolbox and they're important tools, and we need to an integrated approach. Just like most invasive species, the answer is an integrated management approach where multiple efforts are put together.
Tom, let me finish with you. I mean, again, we don't know how many there are, but we know how damaging this species has been to the Everglades and to Florida. But do you think we're ever going to solve this problem, or is Mother Nature just going to beat us out?
We're already in the midst of the solution, and the solution is maintenance, is management. There's been no large reptile that's been introduced, invasive exotic species that's been eradicated. It's a management issue, and the South Florida Water Management District has it together. The FWC, the Everglades National Park, these responsible authorities, the Conservancy over on the West Coast, they're really focused on this. The long-term strategy is management. The swamp apes, I hope, are going to be part of that management tool so the veterans can get the therapy and the enjoyment, the adventure, while we're knocking down this population.
And as you've been saying, the swamp apes, that's your organization. You're helping veterans out. You're bringing them out there with you. And that's as you've been mentioning, I just wanted to point that out. Again, Tom Rahill, he's one of those 25 hunters, is part of the Python Elimination Program. That's through the South Florida Water Management District. They caught their 1,000th python recently, and still, as he said, as Tom said, it's about management and managing this problem, whether we eradicate it, but that's at least a way to look at it. We also talked with Michael Kirkland, who's overseeing the program. Mike, Tom, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for having us and helping to raise awareness to this important issue.
Tom, thank you again, and for everything you're doing to help the veterans. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Lewis.
All right, still to come, major service cuts and so-called ghost buses are causing major problems for bus riders in Miami. We're going to learn more about a program called, a campaign called, Where's My Bus? That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Well, bus riders in Miami-Dade County are waiting longer for their buses to arrive than in past years. And with budget cuts to the transit system and alternative methods like Uber and Lyft, bus ridership in Miami-Dade has decreased significantly. So the nonprofit organization Transit Alliance Miami is pushing for better public transportation solutions in the county. They have recently launched a new campaign called Where's My Bus? This is a 5-week initiative that addresses the state of Miami's bus system through a series of events and conversations online. The nonprofit is looking at the issue of ridership, service cuts, and reliability. Well, the topic they're addressing this week, again, is reliability. In studio with me now is the director of Transit Alliance, Azur Choglay. Call him Oz. Welcome so much, Azur. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You know what? I wanted to mention, too, by the way, because we posted up on Twitter, you know, people who ride the buses here in Miami-Dade, what are some of the things that they're saying? What are they thinking? We did get a tweet that came in from Lucio. He says, how do they expect ridership to increase if they keep cutting service? How are people supposed to ride buses that aren't even there? You know what? You don't have a car, so you've ridden the public transportation system here in Miami-Dade.
Yeah, and I actually moved from New York, and as anyone who moves from a city that comes with excellent public transit, you come to Miami and you expect, well, you know, we have buses, we have trains, we have ways to get around, surely it's possible here. And I'm fortunate to live in a very central location, so I am the exact candidate for transit. You know, I'm young and I have no car, and I live right next to it, and yet it's difficult for me to take transit. So if it's difficult for me, it's difficult. It's much more difficult for someone to choose transit.
And so somebody who's coming from a city like New York, I'm curious, after some time now, how do you rate the way we do public transit in South Florida?
Terrible.
Terrible. Wow.
Terrible. And, you know, terrible, but there's no good reason for it to be terrible. I mean, Miami really can be a city that not only has excellent public transit, but can be walkable and can be bikeable. Can be a city where you can get around without a car. And it really comes down to the decisions that have been made in Miami over the past decades that have made us into such a car-centric and car-dependent city. But it's not the way it needs to be.
You think we could do better. So, I mean, just point out a couple of the things that, you know, that we're not doing right. What are some of the issues?
Well, like you said, when you had people respond to you on Twitter, people are wondering, well, why is ridership dropping? Well, it's because there's no bus to ride, essentially. However, our leadership doesn't really see that as clearly as we do. For example, when we had 78 million riders, 78 million trips on the bus system a few years ago, it started dropping. And leadership has two possible responses to that. One, you can either reinvest in the system and try to get those riders back. Or two, you can cut the system. They chose to cut the system. And so if you cut the system, ridership leaves, and then they're like, oh, well, ridership is falling. We should cut the system again. And so essentially it has become a debt spiral, which has caused a multitude of issues all the way from reliability to buses not arriving at all. And people won't take a system they just can't depend on.
So if the ridership is going down, we should just invest more in it.
Right. And oftentimes people say, well, it's a national trend. Bus ridership is falling everywhere. There's absolutely nothing we can do about it. But that's simply not true. Cities that took the opposite response, in that when bus ridership fell, they started investing in the system, actually see their ridership went up. Cities that responded by redesigning their bus system to actually make it more effective see their ridership go up. Houston and Seattle are fantastic examples of that. So Miami just decided that we're not going to do that.
Yeah, Seattle. So Seattle's an example of a place that is, would you say that they're doing it better?
Much better. And Houston is actually a more closer example to Miami and actually redesigned their entire bus system to be the exact opposite of what it was before. And right now we have a system that's kind of like Houston's old system. We have a lot of routes spread out that go a lot of places very infrequently. So imagine this from a bus rider's perspective, right? And we'll compare it to a car. If you're a bus rider, you walk to the bus stop, you wait there. 75% of bus riders have to wait an average of 30 minutes or more for the bus. So you're waiting there. There's no shelter because most bus stops don't have any shelter. It's raining, it's hot, and then on top of that, the bus tracker doesn't work, so it might never come because a lot of buses do never come. We've statistically found that out, right? That's your experience as a bus rider. Now, compare that to your experience as a car driver. Your car is in your backyard or in your apartment building. You can go it out in this excellent infrastructure. You have all these roadways. It's fantastic. You can drive around. The speed limits are high. And then when you get to your destination, as a society, we've decided that you must have a parking space, so you will have a parking space. Now, when you look at that equation in Miami, can we honestly say that people would choose the bus? And again, there's no reason that people shouldn't. It's we've designed it that way.
Yeah, we do have high speed limits, but I'll also say we have terrible traffic, and it takes a long time while I'm driving.
Right, absolutely. So. But at the same time, if the bus is in the same traffic, would you choose the bus, right? And it's all of these factors that line up together where the bus should be faster or equal to a car. It never is.
The campaign that you guys have is divided in 2 5-week periods. Ridership, service cuts, reliability, route network, and transit demand. So let's start with ridership. So why is it decreasing in Miami specifically?
Well, that's what we really try to explore, because the conversation so far has been ridership is decreasing, full stop. And we want to make that into ridership is decreasing, comma. And the later weeks start to explain it, but basically on the whole, if you have a declining system, you will have declining ridership. That's the main thing to take away.
The system's getting worse, so less people want to ride it.
Right, absolutely. And what's often ignored is that the trolley system, which it's a long story, but it's separate from the bus system. The municipal trolleys, if you're in the city of Miami, you recognize them as orange trolleys. If you're in Miami Beach, they're blue trolleys. They're all sorts of colors. But it's a separate system, and that system is actually see their ridership going up. So, and it's quite significant, by around 10% on average each year. So when you see a system that is gaining riders, you know that, yes, people do want to choose transit when it makes sense.
And isn't the trolley system, or in most cases you see trolley systems are free?
Yes, in pretty much all cases they would be free.
All right. Can you make bus systems the same way or no?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. There's an Eastern European country, I think it's Estonia, that is experimenting with free nationwide public transit. So it's not an idea that hasn't been experimented with in other places. In Miami, there are actually quite a few people who do ride for free, for example, the Golden Passport program, or if you're under a certain height. By that, they mean age. But it's not a viable solution in Miami.
Let's talk about, again, more about why ridership is going down. One of the problems, of course, is we've seen routes discontinued. We've seen less service, basically. And as you said, if they keep looking at the numbers, they keep decreasing the services. So many routes that have been discontinued in Miami-Dade County, what have you heard from riders about how that's impacting their lives? And usually what do riders end up having to do?
Yeah. So most of the bus riders in Miami, as compared to other cities, it's a necessity and they're getting to work. Most other cities have a very diverse transit ridership. And that is a signifier of a healthy transit system. When you have people that are taking it out on the weekends, people who are, you know, just going from one place to the other, not in a work context. In Miami, it's really a lot of people getting to work, and in some cases, it's the only way they can get to work. So when you cut a route, and especially when you cut a route that's not based on data, that's not based on community input, you can do some very bad things. A very good example is Route C. And a lot of people have talked to us about how much they loved Rootsy.
And Rootsy is?
Rootsy is the bus that used to go from downtown Miami to Mount Sinai. And it went from downtown Miami to Mount Sinai through the beach. So on the eastern side of the beach on Washington Avenue. And that route was a very popular route, as are many bus routes that go to the beach. And it was cut, but only the segment that goes from downtown Miami to the beach. So essentially, the part that connects to the rail system, the part that connects to the Metro Mover. What were the reasonings for these cuts? We don't really know. Because in the end of the day, the ridership on that route dropped by 84% over a year. So here's the weird part. Like, they'll make an adjustment to a route like Route C. Ridership drops by 84%. The very next step for that route is for that route to be eliminated. However, they are causing the reason for the elimination.
Reliability. What have you heard from riders? What's the data show about the reliability of our buses? And as we heard from one listener, you know, how do you expect when services are cut and you don't even know where the bus is?
Yeah, so anecdotally, people who have experience with the bus system in Miami know that there are instances where the bus doesn't show up. And they feel like they're crazy. Like, I mean, surely something must be wrong. But actually, between January and March of this year, so the first quarter, 2,103 buses did not leave to start their route. That means that 2,103 times there was someone who was wondering, wow, there really should have been a bus, but it never showed up. I wonder what happened. That's an insane number. It's insanely high.
You said ghost buses earlier. I mentioned it too. What is a ghost bus?
A ghost bus is exactly this. A ghost bus is a bus that should have been there, but that for whatever reason is not there.
If you talk to policymakers, what are politicians, local leaders saying about what to do? And, I mean, are they looking at the data? Do they understand that just because ridership's down, you know what? Don't cut services. Maybe invest more.
Well, I mean, this conversation is kind of just getting started. And the issue in Miami is that decision-making when it comes to transit is so fragmented. We have municipalities, we have the county, we have FDOT, we have the Citizens Independent Transportation Trust. I'm not even going to go into all of the acronyms that we have that try to make a good decision on transit. It's just too long. So this campaign, the goal is to get everyone on the same page with what are the problems, what's going on, and before we can have any sort of significant conversation beyond, hey, transit's doing pretty bad, that's bad, isn't it? We should do something. Before we can even get to the point of, well, actually, this is what we should do, we need to start with, here's what's going on.
Azhar Chagle, again, he is the director of Transit Alliance. It is this nonprofit, again, starting this campaign. They've started a campaign called Where's My Bus? And they're just looking at this information about what's going on with the public transportation system here in Miami-Dade County with the buses and so forth. And why is ridership going down? Because over the last few years, it's been dropping. This is a conversation we're going to keep having more of. So, Oz, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Going to get you back in.
Thanks.
All right, still to come, a new app being developed by a Liberty City teacher could give students an outlet for their mental health needs. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, elementary school teacher Samantha Pratt hears stories of gun violence and tragedy from her students on a regular basis. Pratt teaches at Holmes Elementary School, which sits in the middle of a project in Liberty City. Now, she recognized early that her students needed an outlet to share their experiences, but Miami-Dade schools only have one counselor for every 500 students or so. So she's developed an idea for an app. It's called Click Engage, a web-based application for students to express their emotional state each day with their teachers. Her proposal won third place in the Miami Herald Business Challenge, and she's seeking funding for the app to be developed by the firm Bushido Lab here in Miami. Now, she's off to San Francisco this week for a competition, and if she wins, that's $20,000 in grant funding for the application. Samantha, it's an absolute pleasure to have you in studio. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You came to Miami through the Teach for America program.
Yes, I was a 2015 core member.
Talk about that first experience when you arrived and the things that students were talking to you about.
Yeah, so I had actually studied urban education studies at New York University as one of my minors, and I was kind of familiar with what I would be experiencing, but I wasn't ready by far for that experience when I got here. I was placed at Holmes Elementary in Liberty City, and I taught there my first 2 years, And going into the classroom, I noticed immediately that everything I had studied in my textbooks was coming to life in very real form.
And how so? Like, what would, like, right away, when did you start to see that? What did you hear?
So there was a lot of my students were very low achieving students, which was something I expected, but noticing why. So there's a lot of like negative attitudes. There was very short tempered. I also noticed a lot of signs of trauma. So I had a lot of fifth graders that were like thumb suckers. And like upon research, I found out that was like a side effect of long-term trauma. So I was noticing like behaviors in the students themselves. And then I started to learn more about their home experiences and the stories they would bring through the stories they brought in.
Did they open up right away? I mean, you know, what did you have to find a way to get them to share these stories, or were they really willing to just open up and talk about this?
So there's always the component of developing trust with your students. So that definitely takes some time. But what I thought was most interesting is how willing these kids were to open up, because they're talking about very serious issues like they were a normal everyday occurrence. And I think that was the scariest part.
Gun violence and things like that.
Yeah. There are quick stories about cousins dying, finding siblings dead, taking care of not having an adult in the home for multiple days on end, just noticing students coming in with unclean clothes and just a lot of those experiences, but having the students discuss them like they were normal.
And school lockdowns.
Yeah, we had there was at one point where we had three or four lockdowns in 1 month.
Now, you grew up in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes.
My understanding is you grew up in an area that was similar to Liberty City?
So, yeah, Memphis as a whole is a very, very poor city, and it's not the way the socioeconomic range is stratified. It's like it's either very, very rich or very, very poor. There's not much of an in-between. And I was lucky to have school as my like safe haven. So the schools I was in were definitely good programs that kept me isolated from a lot of instances. But yeah, the community violence was something that was very normal.
So you understood what the students were going through?
Absolutely.
So here you come up with this idea, and I want to know where it germinated. Like, where did this idea come from? You're hearing all these stories, all these kids telling you all this stuff, but, you know, this idea for Click Engage, which is an outlet for them to find help. How did it start?
So I don't want to say there's a single incident because there were so many of them compiled together, but really it came from like pure frustration. So as their teacher, I was trying to get students help for things that were typical for all my students. So in a room of 23 students, maybe 19 of them expressed issues that I thought a counselor should definitely be dealing with. But the problem was we had technically one counselor, but that was very rarely available.
How often would you send a student to a counselor?
Maybe twice in my entire 2 years teaching at Holmes, because they just were never available, and their services are required with our small segment of students that get special ed needs.
All right, so all of this starts happening. So now Click Engage starts to formulate.
Yeah, so I realized I need my students to get the support they needed now. And I was, through these stories, students telling me things that happened the night before or things that happened months ago, I'm realizing I'm missing a lot with them. And I didn't know that the reason they'd come in with a negative attitude was because of these very serious life stressors that they were bringing into the classroom. And I started to wonder, what if I could know each day, like, where my students were coming into the classroom? And could that make me a better educator? But also, could I get them the support they needed faster? And that's really where Click Engage developed from. I knew my kids needed help, and I knew they needed it now. And I thought technology was a perfect bridge for that. That's something that students can easily access, especially in Miami-Dade County schools, where we have a lot of technology in our schools. It seemed like the easiest and most effective way.
So you're still trying to develop this app, and as we mentioned, that you're trying to, you know, gain the funding to build this. But take us through what it would be like. So a student comes into school. Let's say they got Click Engage, whether it's on the phone or computer, but how would it work?
So a student comes in, and during maybe 3 to 4 minutes of the homeroom time, the student's able to respond to 5 survey questions. And those survey questions are really general, like, do you feel safe? Do you feel prepared to learn today? And they answered on a scale. And then based on their answers, they're coded into different groups where they're given tools they can use to cope with their day. So if a student's having a very extreme morning, so they're very negative on the spectrum, they might need time to step out into the hallway or go take a walk or go get some water. Very simple things that kids can do.
And so all the teachers, the principal, everybody would be able to look at every student and see where they are that day you know, emotionally.
Yes. And that's honestly the coolest part about it is, yes, the students get a lot out of it. Students love the space to be able to talk about their emotions, especially those who don't do it well verbally. Doing it via the app has been really helpful. We've seen that with our pilot group. But what's more beneficial is what the teachers get out of it. So the teachers can see in a matter of 5 minutes where every single student starts their day.
And then you'd envision that at that point, if you see students, for example, who are on the far end of that spectrum and they're not feeling safe or they're feeling like this is already a bad day and I haven't even started, that what? You would be able to approach that student, take them aside, get them some kind of help of some sort.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it gives you a space to have a conversation with the student. I can say, I noticed you were red today. I noticed you were yellow. And it gives them a chance to open up. But it also gives you important information. So if you know a student is yellow or red and you see that their head's down or they're not engaged in their learning, instead of being punitive, which is the first instinct, you can adjust how you interact with that child, making it easier for them to learn throughout their day.
Again, I am talking with a teacher here in South Florida. She's actually a teacher at Holmes Elementary School, Samantha Pratt. And she's got an idea for an app. It's called Click Engage. And this is going to be a web-based application for students so they can express their emotional state each day. And this would be a tool that helps teachers and administrators figure out where is the state of mind of their student on any particular day. And then thus maybe give them some kind of help. What else would the app then provide? Now you know what the student's mental state is at that point. Then what else could you give them? What else would it give them?
So it gives them some simple like mindfulness techniques they can use throughout their day. But the teacher, now that they have the information they need about the students, the teacher can adjust their teaching, but they also can track this information over time for students. So one of the biggest problems with getting students counseling services in the schools is the really extraneous process of what you have to go through. So the paperwork can sometimes take 6 to 8 months for one child to get adequate services in the school. And the app, what we're able to do is see if a student is red 2-3 days out of a week, I can immediately say, hey, can you take a second, talk to a school counselor, and see if they need more than what we're doing in the classroom.
Is there any concern that this may add an extra layer of burden and more work for the teacher?
It actually makes things a lot easier. What I found is when students are more adjusted in the classroom and they take that 5 minutes in the morning to just process, and I have that information too, it makes the lessons go smoother. It makes everything that you're doing throughout your day that much easier. So although it seems like adding that conversation might add more work, it actually makes it less work. Because if a teacher were to do one-on-ones with a student with all students every single morning, that could take over an hour. Whereas this takes 5 minutes.
And does it take any of the face time away, the face-to-face that you should have with a person? I mean, is that enough? I mean, I know the world we live in is just technology-driven, yeah. But is there any worry that, well, that counselor time or that face-to-face time is important, not just looking at a screen?
Yeah, so the way I see this is this is a kind of technology that this technology isn't going to change the students. It's going to be the people using the technology that will change the students. So, or change the circumstances the students are living in. So the teacher, yes, like the students are directly engaging with the app, but the teacher having the information and knowing who to go talk to and who to target makes their relationship more meaningful.
You've already started testing this, even though the app doesn't exist yet. You started testing it.
Yeah. So I started prototype development to gather research and really make sure that the build for the app goes well. And I did it out of like Google Drive. I did some Google surveys and I copy and pasted each morning. I am able to manually code the student responses. And I had my fourth graders do it at breakfast every single morning.
So when you first started doing this and you had the students, you know, answer those questions, then you get a gauge of where they are mentally, each of them. How did that change everything immediately for you?
Well, I saw immediately the biggest change I saw right away was the student's dependency on it. So if I were to forget to hand them the technology in the morning to do the survey, the students would come to me and ask for it. And within the first month of my students using it, I was able to red flag two students. I had a student that does not express emotions verbally very well at all. And he asked to use the app to go through his emotions and when he wouldn't talk to any of the adults. And I also had another student who was reporting red really frequently, and I was able to send him to the counselor within 5 days of recognizing that.
Real quickly, how can people best support Click Engage if they want to get involved?
So if you follow us on any of our social media at Click Engage, we have several different campaigns going on right now. But the biggest support we could use right now is donation. So we have a donation site up on givebutter.com. Check out givebutter.com, Click Engage. And we're raising money right now to make sure that we can build this new prototype to reach more schools.
Samantha Pratt, and she invented this app. It's called Click Engage. Will this be the thing that helps students in getting the help they need with mental health issues in the classroom? It's the way of technology, perhaps. Samantha, thank you so much for sharing. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
All right, and that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.